Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. December 1st is World AIDS Day, and we'd like to take a few moments to talk with Lauren Beach, JD, PhD, and you are also a CIDRZ HIV Core Public Health Fellow. Welcome back, Lauren.
Welcome. Thank you so much, Lynn and John. It's a pleasure.
Explain some of those initials.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Explain some of those initials for us.
Yeah, great. So I guess where should I start? There's a lot of acronyms, I think, especially in public health. even HIV and AIDS, the topic of today's discussion, are both acronyms. Maybe it's good to start with them, actually. Is that okay?
Yes, let's do that.
So we're talking about World AIDS Day today, and AIDS stands for Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome, and HIV stands for the Human Immunodeficiency Virus. And these are topics and conditions I've really spent most of my career focusing on at this point. And I'm so excited that the Bicast is doing an entire show dedicated to World AIDS Day. Great. I think it's a great topic. Thank you so much for dedicating your show to this today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very important stuff. It's all part of our life we need to be aware of.
So what is a CIDRZ?
Yes, I think that's a great question, too. CIDRZ, which we lovingly pronounce that acronym as CIDRS here in Zambia, stands for the Center for Infectious Disease Research in Zambia. And it's a Zambian non-governmental organization. Started off as a U.S. NGO, but in 2010, CIDRS went to be a Zambian non-governmental organization instead. And it's really exciting to work for this group. I'm the odd one out here. 95% of my coworkers are Zambian, and I'm strange in that I'm a fellow from America, but it's been really eye-opening for me to work in that type of setting. I really enjoy it, working for CIDRS.
You're part of a project for setting up in hospitals, is that correct, too? Or?
Well, it's my study actually, so the baseline, there's a study that I'm running for CIDRS in my fellowship called Academic, which is about diarrhea prevention in under five children, because diarrhea is actually the number two cause of under five child deaths worldwide. And so they had some work in hospitals and clinics in the baseline. I'm running the online study, which we're visiting 27,500 households in the Saka province as part of this study to evaluate the burden of diarrheal diseases in under five children to see if we can detect a reduction in deaths after the introduction of a new vaccine here.
And there's many causes for these deaths. I studied a little bit about it when I was in nursing school about some of the reasons why these children died. And as part of the thing that happens with malnutrition and also with the bugs they pick up in their own water and things like that. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely. Water and sanitation or the lack thereof are huge issues that relate to diarrheal diseases and deaths in children under five here in sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about your knowledge base of AIDS, which is pretty wide. Oh God, I sound like an idiot. It's huge.
No, you don't. No. I think that I see HIV/AIDS. I'm both a scientist and a lawyer, and I'm very interested in public health and public policy. In addition to those things. And I really see HIV/AIDS as the defining and unifying theme to my career to this point. I would say that scientifically, I spent 7 years doing a PhD in HIV-related biomedical research, including investigation of new drugs and therapies. And also before that, right before I started my PhD, I had the tremendous opportunity to intern at the World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, where I had an internship focused on the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. And really, it was that internship that, you know, I went in and did my PhD in the biological sciences. But then after that, I felt I really needed to go to sub-Saharan Africa because that's where a lot of this problem is worldwide in terms of HIV/AIDS burden. And most people living with HIV and AIDS are actually living in sub-Saharan Africa. So I felt it was disingenuous of me from a social justice perspective not to go and work in the area that was most highly impacted in terms of thinking about this, not just HIV/AIDS as a condition or disease, but as this is, you know, many people on our planet are living with HIV and AIDS. And, you know, I should go and be where those people are at, to be on the front lines and to be, I guess, faithful to my own beliefs when dealing with issues in public health.
Well, we appreciate you and we commend you for your work. It's not easy to stay faithful to what you believe. I know, we know that. So thank you so much.
So, Lauren, you presented on bisexuality plus HIV and AIDS at the talk of the White House in September 2013 with Dr. Harakudi.
Yes.
Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today, but he sent peace to all of us. Could you talk about what you two discussed with the White House?
Yes, definitely. It was really an honor, first of all, I have to say, to work with Dr. Harakudi on presenting at the White House. It was thrilling because he also has, like you said, a rich and extensive background in HIV/AIDS, especially with more of a domestic focus in communities of color, and then LGBT and communities in particular. So, but at the White House, we really highlighted the fact, since it was on Celebrate Bisexuality Day back in 2013 where we went, we highlighted the real and pressing need for the White House to specifically look at communities of color who are also identifying not only as gay but also as bisexual, or even perhaps even more importantly in some of these communities as unlabeled, but still people who would be at high risk for HIV within the wider LGBT spectrum.
Oh, great.
So let's go back to the international area. This UN theme this year is Closing the Gaps, and they put together mm-hmm. a pretty impressive website filled with a lot of data and a lot of goals in mind, really kind of very clear cut. We did notice that bisexual language was missing. And what kind of impact do you think that has for our community? One of the things I noticed is when you look at there is a PDF you can download that shows terminology. And this is true for both gay and bisexual. They read it as a bisexual is defined as a person who is attracted to and or has sex with both men and women and who identifies this as a cultural identity. The expression men who have sex with men with both men and women, or women who have sex with both women and men, should be used unless individuals or groups self-identify as bisexual. And they said the same thing about the gay, using gay. They said to use men having sex with men instead. But then when you look at the hashtags, it actually specifically says, you know, showing the gaps. It says gay and men who have sex with men. So I got a little confused at why they used gay on the hashtag. And it's not
right.
Their present being wanting to be used in the actual terminology.
No, I think you're absolutely right. That seems like an inconsistency within their media strategy to define these sexualities or these, you know, it seems like they're almost using a public health-based behavioral way of looking at risk in this case, which you see a lot, I think, in international public health circles. You see the term MSM, or men who have sex with men, which you just brought up. But personally, I think it is a huge inconsistency to define it one way and then you use a hashtag that says something else.
Yes, and I'm not sure how good that is for us, as we already work under the stigma or the myth of HIV, AIDS being spread to the female population from the bisexual male population. And
yeah.
we talked extensively with Dr. Brian Dodge and Dr. Vanessa Stick about this, and it's my understanding is there's not any real data to prove that. So
no,
this seems like this doesn't really help our case any.
What I've seen that really is effective are little pilot programs in that local governments are doing to actually reach out to bisexual men and closeted bisexual men through social media and hookup sites and places like that. They're really just pilot programs. And, you know, I think that we get missed a lot in HIV education. And there are very different ways to deal with bisexual men and closeted bisexual men, especially bisexual men and especially closeted bisexual men and, you know, MSM, if people don't want to accept the label, have to be educated and brought on board differently than many gay men do. And one of the things I was remarking on just recently was that we actually have an organization that are doing condom packets again, which is really good because for years that wasn't around the gay bars. But those condom packets are only in specific gay bars in town. And there's a lot of places where men are having sex with men where that basic prophylactic isn't available. And so there has to be other ways to outreach. And I think that's why, you know, that's why it's important for us to be targeted separately.
I absolutely agree with that, John. And I'm looking here at the talking points that the HIV/AIDS team raised at the White House back in 2013. And one of them was that designing a quote-unquote MSM, HIV prevention program for gay and bisexual men will not reach many bisexual men because, like you said, bisexual men are less likely than gay men or other members of the LGBT community to identify or even be affiliated with organizations or bars or other types of cultural icons that many people think of when they think LGBT places. You know, they're not, people in our community aren't going out to those establishments oftentimes. And so they're missing out on the benefits of prevention programming that really, even if it says gay and bi, is targeted more towards gay men.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We need to find a way to reach us in our, and like you said, many of us don't even participate in community activity. We
right.
do not. That's, yeah. And that is how, that is one of our goals is to get over that and see how we can reach them.
Well, and I would say that especially in the context where, you know, racism plays a factor in limiting access to LGBT spaces, too. And so when we look at who's most highly impacted in the United States, at least by HIV and AIDS, it is Black and Latino MSM, quote unquote, according to the CDC's website, hugely disproportionately affected. And we think about racism, we think about the use of labels or not use, or using labels in different ways. And, you know, really the work that we're doing isn't reaching out effectively to the communities most impacted by HIV/AIDS in the U.S. either.
You know, and I will include trans men in that. And a lot of
right.
bisexual trans men have come to me and said, you know, the just lack of acknowledgement of their existence within a lot of the public health community when it comes to HIV mm-hmm. and AIDS just burns them up.
Dangerous for him. I mean,
yeah,
because,
it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're, you know, these are people who are smart and take care of themselves, but they're looking at all the people that they run into that aren't.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that people who are maybe less able to access resources. And why would you, and also even if you can access resources, if they're not targeted for you in terms of HIV/AIDS prevention, how are you going to relate? Right. Like it's not, And then also there was this awkward point in time, and you still are seeing this where, you know, you look at some definitions in public health circles and it's not just, you know, so transgender men are completely left out, like you said, John, but then you look at MSM and you realize that MSM as a definition in some circles includes transgender women, which is also problematic, very highly offensive and problematic. So, So, I think that this, but for many reasons, this terminology, while well-intentioned to look at risk in the public health circles of men who have sex with men, can be really problematic in many ways in terms of messaging, reaching our communities. You see this confusion, like you pointed out earlier on the UNAIDS website, Lynn, with like gay versus MSM and how do we go about reaching, you know, this messaging that's so important for prevention. How do we reach out to communities that are not perfectly fitting into what public health researchers think they should be accessing in terms of labels and community spaces.
Yeah, and I see that this could be a problem with actually receiving funding for these programs that would actually reach us specifically, reach our mm-hmm. bisexual and trans communities. Because if we don't have the language saying this is what we need, then we won't receive funding for it. So, and we, that's useful, you know, even pamphlet activity is important. So.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the numbers. What are the real status of AIDS and treatment on a global scale?
Yeah, thanks for that question, John. I really like how the show is digging into the international aspects of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, since by far the vast majority of people living with HIV and AIDS are in low and middle income countries across the planet. So I want to say internationally that there are 11.7 million people who are on treatment. So that's exciting because that's a lot higher than it was back in 2006 when I was interning at WHO, where they had just come across, finished up this 3x5 initiative that they wanted 3 million people in HIV/AIDS treatment by 2005. So you think about that as a goal versus where we are today, which is almost 12 million people in low and middle income countries receiving access to life-saving ART or antiretroviral therapy for HIV infection. Also, the vast majority of people, like I said, living with HIV are in sub-Saharan Africa in particular. I'm in Zambia right now, living in Zambia, working at CIDRS we discussed earlier. In Zambia, there are approximately 14% of the overall population is living with HIV. So that's a huge number. And in some areas, especially in the poorest areas of Zambia, that percentage can be double. So I think that's something to think about too, that, you know, obviously people, I think there's this idea that Africa is a monolithic nation. I would say nation on purpose because I've talked to so many people at home who talk about Africa as being a country rather than a continent, which is embarrassing.
It is.
You know, but I want to point out something though, which is, you know, that we've had progress, but then, you know, this theme in the UN, they have closed the gaps this year with their hashtag, is applicable even when you're living in a country like Zambia in sub-Saharan Africa, which is a low-income country transitioning to a middle-income country right now, which is that the poorest of the poor people, the people who are living with the hardest circumstances, are more highly impacted by HIV. And that's also the case in the United States and other countries in the world, that those who are least well-off in terms of monetary resources are facing disparities when it comes to the burden of HIV in their communities.
40% is a staggering amount, but I'm sure Zambia is not alone in those high numbers.
No. Mm-mm.
So I think the closing the gaps thing is focusing is funding and research on the lowest income people, and that's a challenge in itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think to address HIV, you've got to address social inequality. That's a lesson I see across the entire globe.
I hope that works out well, because that if we could address that inequality, the whole world would be better off. So maybe some good will come.
Yeah, public health is an interdisciplinary undertaking by its nature, and I fundamentally see why I was interested in public health, at least, is I see public health as fundamentally tied to social justice, because I think in terms of the Minnesotan and me, you know, we say we all do better when we all do better. I think Paul Wellstone, that philosophy is really true. And it certainly applies to public health and to World AIDS Day.
And if we're talking about a disease like AIDS, which we want to eradicate globally, because that's the only way it's going to be done, we're going to have to start taking care of everyone, because it won't go away otherwise. It's just a fact. So let's talk some more statistics. Worldwide, 1 million people became newly infected with HIV in 2013. Worldwide, 240,000 children became newly infected with HIV. Mm-hmm. 1.5 million people died from AIDS-related illnesses worldwide. Around 12.9 million people living with HIV had access to antiretroviral therapy, or 37% of all people living with HIV. Only 24% of children living with HIV are receiving the life-saving medicines. Tuberculosis remains, this just breaks my heart. Tuberculosis remains the leading cause of death among people living with HIV. HIV is the leading cause of death among women of reproductive age, and 54% of pregnant women in low and middle-income countries did not receive an HIV test. 60% of all new HIV infections among young people aged 15 to 24 occurred among adolescent girls and young women. AIDS-related illnesses are the leading cause of death among adolescents 10 to 19 years old in Africa.
Yeah, and that really is heartbreaking. And especially to me, looking at the children living with HIV is really concerning, because with modern technology, we can prevent almost entirely, less than 1% at this point, of mothers who are going to give birth to children. Like, we have the technology so that less than 1% of those children would be born living with HIV if mothers were given the appropriate care and treatment, as well as their newborn babies. That's the largest gap in terms of closing the gap that exists across the globe right now, because, simply put, we can prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV. So you look at somewhere like the U.S. and Canada, you know, most of Western Europe, we have almost zero cases of children being born living with HIV. But you look at sub-Saharan Africa, if you don't have any intervention, you know, if women don't know that they're infected, they give birth without being on ART, they have a child who's not given any drugs at birth, and then they breastfeed throughout the child's early life, up to 40% of those children will contract HIV. So you think about that, 0 versus 40%, and it's the biggest gap that there is globally in related HIV. Yeah.
And totally preventable.
Yeah.
Right, and that's so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the stats. You know, when I look at some of these stats, percentages-wise, they kind of match what it is in the United States. But when you look at children and pregnant women with HIV, those are really stats of less developed countries. And it's something that doesn't cost lots and lots of money to deal with. Yeah, testing is economical at this point. So let's move the talk back to the U.S. a little bit. Over 1 million people are living with HIV here. 40% are receiving any kind of medical care for HIV that are infected. And only 3 out of 10 people living with HIV achieved viral suppression. And in here, 14% of people living with HIV haven't been diagnosed.
And that's the U.S.?
That's
the U.S.
Wow. So I'm curious, why do only 3 in 10 living with HIV achieve viral suppression?
Well, I can say a little bit of what I know. One of the problems is Medicaid and actually paying for the drugs that work most effectively, and a one pill a day drugs that are more costly that are being replaced by older drugs. And we've seen this throughout the years of older drugs being used that aren't as effective for people that don't have their own insurance.
Okay, so I'm just going to, from my own standpoint, I received basically HIV therapy for hepatitis C, and they used the older combination of interferon and ribavirin, which did not work for the first, and I had to do it twice the first year. And then they introduced Ciclovec, is that right, into the combination, and it worked almost instantaneously. I've been virus-free for 2 years now, and I switched to whole therapy again. But it was incredibly expensive. If I hadn't been on Medicare, I would have never been able to afford it, because I tried to before, and I just financially could not keep up. So I understand this. This is the language of Medicare is, it doesn't help. I mean, it really makes it quite difficult.
Yeah, and we're seeing states cutting back, especially states that haven't accepted the Medicaid provision of the Affordable Care Act. And so these older drugs are being substituted, and it's just not working.
I think that a lot of, so I speak a little bit to this. I think the president, did you read through the president's announcement for World AIDS Day this year?
Not yet.
I think it's exciting, actually, that President Barack Obama has continued to emphasize the importance of domestic HIV/AIDS-related care. So if you look at the Affordable Care Act, there are expansion provisions, obviously, for Medicare, Medicaid, as well as specifically their provisions targeting HIV/AIDS services and treatment. For expansion, you know, targeting those for expansion. There's also the Ryan White program, which seeks to expand access to life-saving HIV/AIDS medications. But as you said, I mean, there are definitely problems. If there are only 40% of people within our country who are HIV positive who are receiving medical care, I think it's not all that surprising that, only 3 in 10 people in the U.S. are having viral suppression who are living with HIV, because you look at those numbers, 30% have viral suppression, but only 40% are on treatment. Those statistics, I think that they suggest that perhaps that the therapies being given are not what's the problem. It's the fact that people are having a bottleneck to access therapy in the first place. Of course, HIV mutates rapidly. Drug resistance is a huge problem, and first-line medications won't work for everybody. Approximately 18% of all people who become HIV positive will have a drug-resistant strain of HIV from the get-go. So that's a huge problem, too. But I just think that within the U.S., there are a lot of, you know, access to healthcare is the broader issue. And HIV AIDS cases are a symptom of that larger problem, people not being able to access care for a variety of reasons, especially socioeconomic status.
Yeah,
agreed.
And what state you live in, it depends a lot of what kind of treatment you're going to get.
Yeah, it has to become uniform on the policies on that. And so you're talking about some of those things. I wanted to ask you about PrEP and, you know, on an international level. Is that something that is being used? And, of course, the concerns about other STIs that come with it. But, yeah, I was wondering if that is being shown to be any kind of effective yet.
Well, the other thing I want to say, just before we get to the specific topic of PrEP, which I think is an interesting discussion in its own right, I want to just compare and contrast the U.S. situation with Zambia a bit, because everybody in Zambia here who's diagnosed as HIV positive gets access to free antiretroviral therapy. Everybody. All they have to, once they get a diagnosis and they meet the criteria, you know, they get free ART. And it's just a huge contrast. And so, you know, to have, it really broke my heart for my friends back in the U.S. actually, too, to think that they're not, I almost can't talk just because it's so emotional for me to think about people who are being denied access to antiretroviral therapy in the U.S. I see it entirely as linked to race and class and also LGBT status, that, you know, stigma basically for a variety of reasons why people in the U.S. aren't able to access antiretroviral therapy. And I'm excited that being here in Zambia that I see people, you know, anybody and everybody can get access to these drugs if they need them. I don't know. It's a huge contrast.
That's an amazing contrast. That's, I didn't even consider something like that. You know, it should be that way here too.
Yeah, it's kind of an embarrassment for
Well, it's more than an embarrassment. It's a big shame on us. A big, huge one.
Well, in the United States government is the biggest funder internationally of HIV/AIDS medication across the globe too. So you wonder, you know, I'm so excited because it, you know, the biggest burden of HIV infection across the globe is in sub-Saharan Africa. So you can say, yes, there's a huge need. And there, no, but I would never say I'm sad that people here are having access to care and people in the U.S. aren't. I think a person is a person is a person. It doesn't matter where you're living. I do think, though, it says something about the entrenched oppression, systems of oppression in the U.S. that stop us from talking as openly about HIV/AIDS care here as I think that gets, you know, discussed and distributed in the form of aid worldwide by our own government.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. Time to change the language.
Yeah. And I do think part of it too, honestly, like something interesting. So anybody can get access to ARTs here, but homosexuality is illegal in Zambia. And so I think a lot of discussion in the U.S., I mean, and the discussion, the public health outreach is broadened, but still, if you look at the biggest burden in terms of communities living with HIV, it is, you know, Black and Latino men, gay and bi men, other men who use different orientation labels who are living with HIV, and I wonder how much that has to play. It comes out in our political system to this day in the U.S., even with a Democratic administration.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well, and it goes back to those states who haven't accepted the Medicaid money.
Right.
You know, those are a lot of those states are Republican controlled, and a lot of this is state based medical care. And so, you know, the federal government can try to get everybody in the states on board, but it really comes back to the states not doing what they need to do.
Yeah, in terms of setting up health care exchanges, really implementing solid access to care strategies. I agree. Like, one of the other things that I think is different here that I've seen be very effective is a lot of the medical care is truly public health based. There are patient trackers in every clinic I've come across in the Lusaka province. You know, if you don't show up for your appointment to get your medication, they will try to find you. They'll call you. They'll go to your house. They will, and it doesn't matter if it's for a maternal child health care appointment or for HIV infection. They'll try to contact you. And the public health is seen as a community issue, and I think in a stronger way than it's even seen in the U.S.
I think that's a big point right there, is that we tend to separate HIV patients off as a moral, not, we make it a moral issue and make it more focused on something wrong with the patient rather than realizing this is a community issue. And that's part of my medical training is and learning about epidemics and all of those things, is people need to take it away from there and realize this is global impact, and the only way you deal with this is as a global village, as a community.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
I was going to say, yeah, I that point, I was in another part of Africa, in South Africa, how women who aren't really that well-trained on the medical issues are hired to help other peers in issues like depression and elder issues. And, you know, that type of public health that we don't even think about doing here, which isn't really that expensive, which really is effective. You know, it's something that we really need to be looking at as we move forward in public health.
Yeah, I think you still see so much stigma, like you were saying. Like, people think if you have HIV, you deserved it. It's your fault you're infected, and therefore this is what's coming to you. And that attitude leads to more death related to HIV needs. Yeah.
It causes death. You know, we have people have to realize viruses do not care who you are, where you are, what you are, nothing. They're opportunistic. They'll get in any way they can. You know, and you have to think of this as a virus and not as some moral issue, and just realize, you know, it's like, you know, you have to change the language.
Right, and viral suppression is really important because people are in the world, and if we want to stop AIDS, we have to do a better job in suppressing the virus in people that have AIDS. It really is a public health issue.
Yeah, I really fear for the virus to keep mutating rapidly again, like it was, and it scares me. And which brings me back to PrEP again. Kind of in a really roundabout way. And talking about STIs. So is that being used globally yet?
I think PrEP, so we should just say what it stands for. PrEP is pre-exposure prophylaxis. And what that means in the context of HIV and AIDS is that people who are HIV negative would be taking antiretroviral therapy so that they would not acquire HIV. Because it's been known for a long time that if you take these anti-HIV medications, that if you're exposed to an HIV, you know, say that for whatever reason you come into contact with HIV, you're much, much, much less likely to get it if you're taking these drugs already than if you aren't. Right. And you don't know that you've been exposed, for example. So people at high risk for HIV, especially in the U.S., PrEP is being given now to high-risk communities, including the quote-unquote MSM, gay and bisexual men, you know, people at high, who would fall in these communities where the prevalence of HIV is much higher, and so the exposure is more likely, and PrEP can have some benefit. Okay, so that's in the U.S. context. But you're asking, I think, Lynette, your question was about the international context. Is that right?
Because from my understanding, that the policies aren't even really clear yet on who and when to give it. So I was wondering if it was on an international level being promoted yet.
So I think the ethical discussion shifts a bit because if you're living in a country where access to antiretroviral therapy isn't universal, then you're asking a question of, should we give these drugs to somebody who's not infected and who we can prevent an infection, or should we give them to somebody who's already infected and needs these drugs for care?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so right. I think that, yeah, it becomes a little more complicated in that context because you're thinking about saving a life versus preventing a life with HIV, and they're both really compelling causes, right? But I think you need to consider that a little bit differently than in the U.S.
Right, so maybe down the road, when there is better control over this, that might be something that's possible. But at the moment, it's really not feasible to do that.
Okay, no,
considering
but
resources.
Yeah.
Well, maybe when
right.
there's
What's
a generic.
The,
and even here, it's like, you know, PrEP medication is very, very expensive, and compliance is really an issue already, making sure that people are taking their dose. Another piece that we've even talked about within our own community is, you know, who are the most at-risk populations? And yeah, MSM is one of the risk populations. Other risk populations are bisexual women who have sex with men. Another population are women who live with HIV-positive partners. And when these women go to try to get PrEP, they're told that they're not part of the targeted population.
Yeah.
And they really are people that need to be targeted also.
So they got a lot of issues with policy. John told us the story of a young boy who has never even been active sexually yet and asked his doctor about it. And his doctor was like, going to put that boy on PrEP, you know, when he found out he was gay. And it was like, totally not appropriate. And so, you know, that kind of thing needs to be pretty clear, you know, when and where and who to reach.
The CDC has issued some preliminary guidelines. They're available on the website. I can send you that link. And early on, some of the discussions really were focusing, you know, about accessing PrEP. I think the first guidelines were at least were actually about the quote-unquote MSM community. But you can look through, I think, that document for people who want to learn more. So we'll post that.
Great. Yeah. I'll make sure to get that on the links.
Our community center has a grant to do trials for PrEP. And really, one of the things that has been missing so far is that community aspect of the outreach. Doctors who aren't really well trained in HIV aren't always the best people to be prescribing PrEP. There needs to be more learned about compliance and non-compliance, and you know, these are the kind of trials that need to be out there in order to figure out some of what's going wrong and how to do things better.
Well, then it should be included with continuing education. I don't know what doctors have to go through, but if you're a nurse, you have to comply with continuing education guidelines every 2 years or every 4 years. It used to be every 2 years. So, you know, I think that's part of the thing, too, is reaching the medical community and teaching them. And, of course, everybody, just to remind you all, take your PrEP does not prevent you from getting other STIs, so you still need to put your rain suit on.
Yeah, and it's not even PrEP is not even a surefire way to prevent HIV. It just dramatically reduces the likelihood you'll get it. But the best way to prevent HIV infection is to use a condom or to, you know, abstain from sex, basically. But I think condom use is much more realistic.
Yeah, I think so too.
So it's like condom plus. Like PrEP can supplement the protective effects that condom use brings you for people who would be at risk for HIV, which is, you know, I guess everybody, but some people, if you're in a high-risk community, you need to think about this more critically for your own health. How's that?
That sounds good.
And also, yeah, your question about your comment about doctors, John, I think it's an interesting situation because, yeah, perhaps we want doctors more educated with HIV, you know, more specialist-type people to think about giving out PrEP, but at the same time, if we think about the resource gaps in the U.S., you know, accessing a specialist is really out of reach for most people who are most highly impacted with HIV or at risk for HIV. So there's this balancing act I think we need to consider about access versus quality of care, because, you know, if a specialist, you know, PrEP, the cost of PrEP is a barrier alone. But then accessing a separate doctor on a different tier also is a barrier to think about as well. And it's interesting. I'm not sure like what we'll see emerge, you know, because I know there is a movement within medical training that doctors who are not specialists should be providing primary care that includes HIV/AIDS-related treatment and prevention. So I'm not sure, though, about PrEP, since it's so new. How do we best get people to utilize that in a way that's most safe and effective to prevent this further spread of HIV in our communities?
Yeah.
I specifically asked my physician's assistant, and she had no idea what it was.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was like, "You really?" Yeah. You know.
Yeah,
I was amazed. I mean, you know, I mean, I would think every medical person's heard of it, and she's like, "I don't know what that is."
Yeah. Well, that tells you something about another thing. I mean, one of the most interesting parts of our interview talking to Dr. Dodge was about how HIV and all other STIs during history have been combined and separated as though HIV is a completely different category of STIs. And then other times it has been more integrated with in the public health sphere, dealing with some of the other STIs that people face. And, you know, like I read a statistic saying that in the West Coast, gonorrhea diagnosis among MSM is going through the roof, and nobody's really thinking about that. So, you know, sometimes it's like when you think of STIs, HIV is one of that class of viruses.
Well, I think the part of that is that, we got a handle on that. We can deal with that. They're not panicked about it. You know, which is how
it doesn't
it doesn't kill you. It just does all kinds of other wonderful, lovely things. So, you're right, John. We tend to stop realizing that, you know, just by nature of being human beings, we are, you know, we have targets on our back about everything, you know, so we have to be aware.
Yeah. And sexuality is a part of humanity, and, you know, sexual behavior, I mean, it's not an uncommon thing. So to act like it's somehow unusual or scary or funny, you know, I think that's also part of, you know, that stigma lends itself to fidgeting around where should HIV fall? Should it be an STI? Should it be on its own? Can we talk about STIs? I just feel it overall, if I think it's better, I almost would think it was better if we thought of HIV like diabetes, or if we think about gonorrhea like the flu, or if, you know, like thinking about diseases that somehow lack stigma, I really feel like the sexual aspect of STI, you know, in terms of that term, and it definitely impacts our lack of response or inappropriate response to STI management overall.
Yeah.
I think that, I totally agree. That's one of the things that I've always, you know, found really part of the biggest problem is people, you know, they think AIDS, they think sex. And, it's clear that the virus has no inclination worrying about sex. I mean, you know, so it's hard for me to explain what I'm saying. It's not a sex virus. It's not the only way I can say that. It's a virus, and it's an opportunistic virus. It'll get in any way it can, you know, and it has, you know, you don't have to have sex with somebody to get AIDS, you know, and I think that's part of the problem.
You don't, but it's also like sex is it's the primary route of transmission for HIV. And I feel if HIV were transmitted through, I don't know, contact with the eyes or nose, or if it were only a bloodborne transmitted infection, perhaps it would have a different, we would be approaching it, the treatment differently. And that's really unfortunate because when you think about public health, I think it's about health. It's not about, it shouldn't be about how did you get some sort of, it should be how can we maintain the healthiest population possible. And that's where if we were going to do that, we would combat racism, poverty, inequality. We would think about sexually transmitted infections the same way we think about any other type of illness. We would see mental illness needs to be treated the same way that physical illnesses are, even though I think that's kind of mental physical is kind of a false distinction anyway. But, you know, we would just think about how can we be truly healthy ourselves and in our communities and our countries and our planet, and that's truly what public health means to me. And I feel that the more we can get that message out and apply it to every sort of health day there is, whether it's diabetes, World AIDS Day, whether it's SDI education, it doesn't matter. Like, that's what public health is about. And World AIDS Day, I think, should really be about raising awareness about HIV, but also thinking about truly global public health. And so, again, I'm so excited that you talked about the international aspect of this as well as domestic for World AIDS Day for your show today. Thank you.
You're welcome. And we agree with you. It should be, we should be under, we should be, it should be world health. We should all be striving for the same thing.
Yeah. And remember, just about every one of us got into this planet because of sex.
Yeah. Right.
So sex is actually, it's a useful thing even for reproduction.
Right.
Well, you know, even if you think about it, if you were in vitro, I mean, that's still part of the sexual process. So.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah.
Okay.
I would just say one other thing is that the other way of transmitting HIV is through IV drug use. And we've also saw the prejudices around needle exchange programs. We saw it here in D.C. when the federal government kept the city from doing its needle exchange program some years back. So these stigma, you know, kind of just among the least of us denying needed treatment.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know how it is now, but it used to be here in Oregon. All you had to do was go into a pharmacy and ask for a bag of syringes, and they would sell it to you.
Yeah.
You know, and without any questions, you know, because that was the policy. I don't know what it is now. I'm hoping it's still the same thing. You know, so. Okay, I guess we better wrap up. Would you like to add anything, Lauren?
I would say just Happy World AIDS Day, everybody, and I hope that this show has encouraged people to think more deeply about HIV/AIDS in a global context and to think about it in terms of our own society and the fault lines it shows and highlights in terms of, you know, I don't know if we can get through the show without mentioning Ferguson, Missouri.
Better do it, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think I can't. Like, I really see public health, as I was saying, is an issue of social justice. And you think about health disparities, it's low income communities of color, communities, you know, LGBT communities, women who are disproportionately affected by HIV and AIDS. And I see public health and the lack of access to health and healthcare, is intricately tied into, larger systems of oppression that we need to address. And I see World AIDS Day as an opportunity to talk about that. So thanks for giving that opportunity.
Great.
Absolutely.
Yes. All the links will be provided on the website. And one thing I'll add to everybody listening to this, if you haven't been tested recently, go get tested. There are places to get tested for free, anonymous, and it, even if you're really sure you're not HIV positive, it's always good to keep that test active.
Mm-hmm. It's always good to have that. It's a way of thinking. It's a knowledge, and having that knowledge base. And you can't preach that if you don't do that.
Well, I would say, I would go farther. It's a way of loving yourself and your community. If you want to combat, everybody should go get HIV tested. If you've gotten tested and you're not, you don't have that same kind of fear, either to know your result, go with a friend. Even if you know your status, go with a friend and take them to get HIV tested. Go with your family member to get HIV tested. Encourage those around you to get tested. Because it's been shown that people who know their status are less, if they find that they're HIV positive, you're much less likely to transmit that virus in the future. And if you know that you can stop that way, it contributes to a larger whole to help improve the community health of all. And I would say, love yourself, love your community, go get tested.
Great.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's a great way to put it in bold. Thanks.
Yeah. Yes. All right, everyone, I want you to remember you are not wrong, you're not broken, and you are not alone. You are a human being, and you are bisexual, and you are part of the world global. No, you are part of the global village. We're all in this together.
Yes.
And I've always thought about the whole thing with polio and why people aren't seeing this as the same process. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why it's taking so long. Of course, like you said, it has to do with the language and how we think about it. So, mm-hmm. All right, guys. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Yeah, 58% was the that the statistic that they had for women?
What I put in, 54 did not
54?
See. No, that's who didn't. 54% of pregnant women in low and middle income countries did not receive an HIV test. HIV is the leading cause of death among women of reproductive age, and 54% of pregnant women in low and middle income countries do not receive an HIV test.
Yeah, it's really staggering. That's one of the
leading
things
cause
about
of death. In Africa.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.
This is Saint Zero from the Headphone Bleed, and you're listening to the Bicast. Symptoms may include an open mind, sense of community, shinier hair, and whiter teeth.
Results may vary.
You can catch me every Saturday night at www.live365.com/stations/Saint Zero.
Nip it back.